them at attack methods, and we try to come up with ways to defend ourselves against those particular attacks. And granted, there are principles, there are models, and there are metrics, but we don't really have a general view of what security is enough to call it a science. And at NSF, we're interested in that, and that'll be part of the kinds of proposals that we're interested in for the trustworthy computing. And we're also going to have sort of separate activities on the science of security, which I mean is workshops, and we're going to report that out. Also, my colleague at NSF, Darlene Fisher, runs a program called FIND, Future Internet Work Design, and the goal is, the lofty goal is to think, okay, where's the internet headed? Can we think of a day when the internet will look very different from what it is now, and what do we need to make it more secure, more manageable, get more bandwidth, and the litany better than I do. So we always use Genie as a possible vehicle for evaluating new ideas, a network, new technology networking, as well as new kinds of experiments. Okay, so those are sort of the main drivers for Genie, at least as I see it, and I'm sure you can think of others. So, all right, so let me talk a little bit about some of the issues I mentioned to start off the talk. Okay, so we want to protect Genie, and when I first arrived at NSF, my then colleague Guru Parukar said to me, okay, so what can we do to protect Genie itself? And he said, okay, and I don't want to wait 30 years for you, me, the security community, to come up with its ideas. We don't have that much time. So he says, we don't want perfection, but we want to make it secure enough. Okay. So we're here with secure enough, and there we want perfection. That's a huge gap. Okay. So I liked the discussion before about, what we'd like to do is be able to, let's say, shut down a slice that's misbehaving. I think that would be great. If we can, convince ourselves that we can do that, ideally for any kind of an experiment that somebody would run, that would be fantastic. Okay, so that's one way I think we might be able to use existing technology. Okay, how to protect Genie from outsiders coming in, trying to break it, trying to make Genie a botnet, that's another story we want to deal with. Okay, so there's a talk yesterday, I can't remember who gave it, but talking about authentication and access control, so sort of the linkage between those two, and I think that's great. That's a great starting point. If we can't authenticate users and we can't control the resources they get access to, we're dead. So I think that's certainly the right thing to look at. Okay, but it's not enough. Because we keep talking about, and you use these words very, very eloquently, okay, experiments running wild. Okay, so how can we tell if an experiment's running wild? Well, in my lingo, and I've sort of been involved in intrusion detection, we have to monitor systems. Okay, we monitor the health of Genie, monitor the health of a Genie slice, and in that regard, intrusion detection seems to be the right approach to take. Okay, so the question is, we might want to look at known attacks, which is one thing intrusion detection is doing. We're going to say, is this experiment doing different things than it has done in the past? Well, that's not going to work, okay, because we haven't run these experiments before. So one thing that seems to make sense is a technique called specification-based intrusion detections, and I think you're getting this right in the sense that experimenters should say, okay, what resources will this experiment need? And hopefully the experiment will get access to them, and I think that's what you're working on. And more than what resources they need, how will they use those particular resources? So conceivably, if the user, the experimenter can specify these, then we can actually monitor what that experiment is doing, and if it's misbehaving, you would respect to the resource request that it made, then maybe we can shut it down. Okay, that would be very nice if we could do that. Now, that's not the whole problem, because the user may know glitches, may know vulnerabilities in Genie, so that it can it can exploit them. It can make it look like it's doing fine with respect to our monitoring devices, but it's misusing the resources. Okay, it's essentially these resources that separate slices from each other. So, now, beyond that, I think what was mentioned before was, how do we share alerts, and how do we actually want to shut down resources, and I think these are good problems to work on. Okay, now, what I might add is that when I first came to NSF, we had a particular story that we sort of backed off on a little bit. They said, we could see Genie evolving into the next generation internet, and and I'm not the only one to say this, Vince Cerf at a public meeting said, gee, this is great. This is a great goal, you know, for Genie. And you know, we're not saying much because this would be very ambitious. But what I see happening is that Genie will largely built to a significant degree out of legacy code to begin with, and legacy code comes with vulnerabilities. But I think we could, over time, replace some of the legacy code that perhaps is insecure with more secure versions. Okay, you know, to do separation of experiments and the like. So that's something you know we might still consider with regard to security. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about experiments and all these things. Heidi Willing, you know, we should have discussion about these, okay? And we'll continue to have them, you know, over the next few years, I'm sure. Okay, so what I'd like to get some discussion on is what kind of experiments we'd like to run on Genie and that are related to security. And some of these we could think of sort of, related to the science of security. We're trying to understand limitations of security, how secure we can make systems. Ellen gave this very compelling question for Jeannie Joe. Do we want the reliability, and she said reliability of the internet to be a certain number of nines? Well, and as you pointed out, well, what does it mean? Okay, reliability with respect to what kind of attacks or what kind of threats, and that's where security can come in. Okay, so what kind of security experiments can we run on Genie? And I see this as being something very very interesting and worth discussion. Okay, so we might want to we have the opportunity to look at attacks, threats on all levels, from layer one up, and this gives us a unique opportunity to do this and in a very large setting. So what I like to think about in terms of security is that there could be attacks on the network core itself. And attacks on the endpoints. Now, right now, I think we're mostly suffering from attacks on the endpoints, and that might continue for a while. But we all know that there are vulnerabilities, in the core. So we can attack the core or the endpoints. We can also defend at the core or the net or the endpoints. So how can we? And I think we can run all these kinds of experiments in Genie, particularly those that involve the network. We're just looking at endpoints. And maybe we don't need Genie that much. Okay, so what are examples of some kind of experiments that we can run? Well, I'd like to understand phenomena of attacks like worms or botnets. Okay, to learn. Well, let's see. For example, worms can be self-limiting, right? Because they can use up all the resources in the network. So can we learn more about them? Okay. And perhaps with instrumentation in various places. Okay, can we look at techniques to measure botnet activity and see how the measurement devices can be defeated? Can we run games between attackers and adversaries? Okay, attackers and defenders. The defenders might want to use deception at various places. Okay, see, can we fool the attacker? And I think those kind of experiments that we can run, and we can run experiments like and this is what I thought about when I first got to NSF. We could drop potentially the existing internet protocols into protocol stack, into Genie, and say, okay, what would it take to bring down the current internet? Now, I've been told that NSA knows the answer to this, and they won't tell us. Well, but there are experiments that we can run in this regard, and perhaps I think we should. The cascading phenomena that we don't understand yet. So I think all of these, I think we could do. Okay, so in addition to asking you to suggest experiments, and you can do this online or offline, is so the question is how are we going to make Genie more secure? Okay, I think one approach would be to fit security into some of these existing projects that you have, In large regard, this might be retrofitting, say putting intrusion detection in. Snort was mentioned before as a possibility, and John mentioned, well, we're going to need something faster than existing snort, so we'll need snort that can operate at gigabits. But there's also other efforts which are working faster. There's a system called Bro, which Vern Paxson has worked on for NSF. And that can work at higher speeds because he's looking at the parallelization of it. So all these are research prototypes that I think we can fit retrofit into Genie. Okay, some other questions. How can Genie evolve as we learn more about security? As we learn more about insecurities in Genie, how can it evolve to become more secure? So it could be an ongoing platform for just improving security overall. I raised the question about live malware, and I was happy to see about this, that discussion, and that relates to acceptable use policies and the like, as well as some technical stories. And I think that's mostly it. Okay, so I'm open to discussion about security, and I guess what I'm interested in is, what can we do to make Genie secure? And this will relate to policy and also what experiments will run and anything else you'd like to discuss. Or do you want to do the other lightning talk or whatever you like? Yeah, okay. And I might add that as far as trustworthy computing, which is the program that I help manage at NSF, I can see as Genie becomes available that we would fund research projects that would make use of Genie. I can certainly see that, we welcome projects that make use of Deter and Orbit and Whale. So we'd certainly want to do that for Genie too. Sure.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for your comments. Let me just ask a question, maybe get a little discussion going.
Sure.
I found myself being very skeptical of this sort of profile-based security, that it's actually a realistic thing that a researcher would be able to describe the resources that he thinks an experiment's going to run in.
Good question.
But I actually have no practical knowledge of the matter. And so, are you aware of, are there implementations that actually do this? Is there a running code? Have people proven that this is a reasonable approach? Or practical, I guess is the word.
Oh, okay. So, for experiments, I don't know yet. Okay, that's interesting. We should try that out. For another instance, so I have a student of mine, I don't know if he's in the room, Calvin. Okay, anyway, so he's the quote inventor of the specification-based intrusion detection. So there's some things you can do. You can conceivably specify for particular privileged programs what resources they should use. Now, it's a long way from that to experiment running specification. So you can specify what system calls they should use in advance, or you can learn them. Okay, there are two ways to do it. So in that case, I think it's been proved fairly successful. Okay, we have specifications for network protocols. Maybe we can use those as the basis for, as you call it, profile-based intrusion detection. But it's a good.
My concern is that it has the risk of creating an enormous hurdle for experimenters to understand the behavior of what they're doing to a high degree before they could put something on Genie. Maybe there are alternative strategies where there are some sort of general purpose profilers that you could run the thing in an isolated environment and see if the researcher thinks it's behaving normally, then you can measure the envelope that it takes up. On the other side, there's the diversity of the different kinds of things. We're talking about configuring routers and switches and wireless stuff and software-defined radios and so getting outside of a PC it also makes the problem harder.
You're right. It may become too high a hurdle. That's true. Okay. Okay.
I wish we had a backup plan.
Okay. Anything else? Okay.
Okay, I'm just going to give a talk. No PowerPoint slides for this. It's a lightning talk, so you don't need to be bothered by the slides. And so I just want to give, I'm John Lockwood. I want to give a quick update on the NetFPGA project from Stanford University. And so if you're not aware of the NetFPGA project, what it is a, it's a hardware accelerator that allows doing wire speed gigabit networking in hardware. And it's an open source project. So there's, you can go to the website and download Verilog code that runs on the NetFPGA that implements things like an open source IPv4 router. There's also network security things for doing firewalls, IDS, and snort that have been implemented for the FPGAs that can be run on the NetFPGA card. And there's also several GD projects that are using NetFPGA, like in the EmuLab and Deter Testbed, that have big clusters of NetFPGA systems. And so as of today, the update is that we have 500 of these cards deployed in 18 countries around the world. And so the uptake on these has been faster than we had expected. And so the company that's manufacturing this, which is the low-cost company called Digilent, which is the manufacturing partner, is currently sold out of the cards. And so the news I have as of this morning from Digilent is that the next batch of 500 cards, which they're building now, is going to be available on November 17th and shipping on November 17th. And so the cards will be available from them. If you're interested in using the cards, Digilent is taking the back orders right now. And so looking ahead for the next 12 months, we anticipate going through those 500 cards plus probably building a total of about 5,000 of these NetFPGA cards. And one of the uses that will be described shortly is the NetFPGA card was used as the first open flow hardware accelerated router. And so Jad Naus, who's a graduate student at Stanford, will be giving a talk, the first talk at ANCS conference next week, is on the implementation of the open flow router on the NetFPGA. So we look forward to Jad's talk and going through the steps it took to convert the FPGA card into an open flow router and do that with hardware support. We're also looking ahead at uses of building a 10 gigabit version of the NetFPGA. And so that's 10 gigabit per port with four ports. So depending on how you count, that either gives you 40 gigabits per second of bandwidth bidirectional, or 80 gigabits if you count it coming in and going back out. And that's wire speed, so that these are actually hardware finite state machines that are taking even minimum size packets and doing packet processing on those minimum size packets. Or of course, you know, you can use larger MTUs as well. That's easier in terms of header processing. And so if you have an application that needs 10 gigabit networking, I'd be interested to hear about it, is that we're putting together, collecting information about the intent. And so if people intend to use 10 gigabit cards, we'd like to know how many people and how many cards would need to be manufactured. We're going to try, and we expect to, as we did with the original NetFPGA, to get donated parts from the vendors. So the reason that FPGA card is so inexpensive is that companies like Xilinx and Micron and Cypress and Broadcom have all donated hardware to us. And so going forward, we're going to try to get them to donate hardware again for the next version of the NetFPGA. And so if you're interested in using it and can help by identifying your intent to use it, I can take that to them to help motivate them to donate the hardware for you. So that is the current update. All the details about the project are online. So if anything, the only thing you need to remember out of this is a website, which is netfpga.org. And so all the details about what people are doing with the card, including the contributed projects that people are starting to build, are on the NetFPGA website. And there's also a wiki that has the user contributed content, so you can download the board schematics, the designs, and the contributed designs from the wiki. And we're also, one other final announcement is that for people that are developing and have built NetFPGA applications, we're planning on holding a developers conference next year. And so if you are, if you have a circuit and you'd like to let the world know what it does, we're going to be organizing an event. It'll probably be at Stanford University, so in this neighborhood, about this time next year in August, where we'll invite people to come and show off what they've done with the NetFPGA. We'll probably be doing that in the same week with another week-long tutorial series. So if you have students that maybe they haven't used the NetFPGAs, we'll be giving another tutorial at Stanford following probably the 5-day format that we've used before to give people an opportunity to use the CAD tools, run through the reference router designs, synthesize circuits. We have a test bed of 10 computers that people can use to do real IP routing between the machines. And so within that 5-day period, we can give a training session that covers that. So any questions? Yes.
So how does this compare with, say, with some commercial products that try to do this? I'm thinking Cloud Shield, is that one that? I'm just curious.
How does it compare to the commercial products?
Commercial products, I'm sorry.
Well, we have some of the same hardware inside. Is that okay. This card is completely built with FPGA hardware for processing.
Right.
And so it gives the freedom to implement any type of packet processing function. It's not limited by the there's no predetermined architecture on how we process packets. So anything from layer 2 and up can be programmed natively. The other aspect that's different is cost, is that by getting the vendors to contribute the parts, is that the cost of this is $500. And so, you know, most of the vendor solutions are about $10,000 as a starting point. And so this is $500. And the card fits into a standard PC. So, you know, in Emulab, they've actually put the cards into the clusters, or they're working on putting the cards in the cluster. We were working with Jay right up until a few months ago. At Stanford, though, we have a cluster of 40 PCs that have the NetFPGA cards installed and running. The big difference is we try to keep it simple and we try to keep it cheap. And so if you're looking for a real high-end product right now, that there's vendors that make better high-end products. And if you're doing 10 gigabit, you know, we're starting the project now to do the open source 10 gig, but we currently have the 1 gig. That, you know, the vendors might have a better solution for that. But if you want something that's, you know, open source, easy to use, and inexpensive, that's what the goal of this project is. Yeah.
John, can you just say something about where you are in the development of the 10 gig version and when you expect it to be available?
So the 10 gig project is starting now. So we've been in discussions with Xilinx about manufacturing the card and doing the layout. We have a pretty good idea that the features of the card will be quite similar to what we have right now. It'll be 4 ports, 10 gigabit on each port. There'll be onboard SRAM and onboard DRAM, so there's enough memory capacity to do packet buffering so you can implement a quality of service systems. There'll be probably a Vertex 5 FPGA or better that lets you do the deep content inspection so you can see every byte as they go through the system, which is useful. The data path of it will be very similar to what we have right now with the 1 gig NetFPGA. On the 1 gig NetFPGA, the data flow is 8 gigabits per second with all the ports combined. And so on the next generation card, there'll be 4 parallel engines, each doing about 15 gigabits per second. So the native bandwidth on the card will be about 60 gigabits per second going through the packet pipeline. Or I guess 120 gigabits if you count it twice, but with 10 gig ports. But we're looking for input. Is that, you know, the schematic is not locked down yet. If there's particular features like TCAMs or you know, we're deciding between DDR3 and DDR2 memory that people would like to see on the card, we still have time to get those changes in. Yeah.
And when do you expect it to be?
We're shooting for 12 months from now. And so we hope to have the first prototype cards available by this time next year and stay on schedule.
Is it 10 gigabit CX4?
The 10 gigabit, to be determined, is okay. That it'll probably be a small SFP package so that you can put either optic or copper modules in. We'd like to make it so the form factor still fits into a PC, because in the I/O expansion slot, it's useful to be able to plug in those cards and have it still fit in a PCI Express slot. So we're going to try to follow that model and use a small enough form factor that the whole card can just fit into one expansion slot of a PC. And of course move from the PCI bus, which it is right now, to a PCI Express card so that you can get a lot more bandwidth to the host processor. Any other questions? Okay, I'll be around over lunch. If anybody has ideas or suggestions, things you'd like to see, I'd be happy to take those.
Okay, so we're actually breaking about 5 minutes early, but there's a scheduled international BOF, which is going to be some conversation over lunch for folks that are here from outside the United States who want to talk about ways of interacting with Genie. That's going to be in, I think it's in one of the poster rooms. It's you'll see there's a sign down the hallway towards where the posters were. It's not exclusive. Anybody who's interested in being part, just pick up one of the bag lunches out there and head down to the table. Chip and I are going to join in a couple minutes. We'll probably wait to start the conversation until the other group shows up. There's no urgency there. And then we reconvene, I believe, at 2 o'clock for another plenary session that'll then run out the rest of the day. And I think we're on schedule to end a little bit early, as Craig mentioned this morning. So, thank you.